115 in the harmony. Now, the harmony, of course, arranges all four Gospels into parallel columns so that we can look at similar material all at once there. And we will be looking shortly into Mark chapter 8 as our basic text. So if you do not have the harmony or prefer to work with your regular study Bible, then we'll be in Mark chapter 8 in just a minute. But as you're turning to the page, either 115 or Mark chapter 8, then I want to spend just a few minutes getting a new location established for us. Thanks to excellent material that Lewis Keene presented last week on prayer. Glad for that, but of course we did not have his class, so it's been some 2 weeks since we were here looking into the Gospels. Let's get the setting once again. Here is a typical map of Israel, which is about 150 miles from Dan to Beersheba, as it's sometimes referred to there in the Old Testament. On this particular map, I want to zoom in now to that area, northern area, which the most prominent geological feature, of course, is the Sea of Galilee. And so the country there is also named Galilee. Jesus has made his home on the north shore, as you'll recall. He has been preaching and teaching there for months and months now in the course of our study. The great majority of his 3.5 years of preaching are going to be conducted here, most of it on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. And by the tens of thousands, people have gathered from all over Israel to hear what he had to teach, but also, of course, to see his miraculous powers and to benefit from them if they could. We had come up through John chapter 6. We had seen in the 6th chapter that Jesus' popularity had risen to such a degree that they wanted to make him king. They wanted to force him to become king. He had to rebuke them because of their misguided desires with regard to how they viewed the miracles and the purpose of those miracles and how they viewed him. He had effectively to flee from them, leaving them to go up onto the mountain to pray. And so throughout all of this, the presence of these crowds has become something of a hindrance. But on that fateful day in John chapter 6, that tide broke. Jesus does rebuke them. They get the point that he is expecting and demanding that they rise up to his expectations of them. And so by apparently the thousands, people then turned away from him as well. So his popularity has peaked. Many, many people have left him. And immediately after that event, Jesus, for the one time in his preaching career, leaves the territory of the Jews altogether. Now, he was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. We read that very passage 2 weeks ago. But that does not mean that he was forbidden to teach the Gentiles. Gentiles came to him within the confines of Israel proper. But on this occasion, he heads off some 34 miles, a direct line of sight, up to the north and west and goes to the port of Tyre. And then another 22 miles, he hikes on up the coastline to the city of Sidon. And we have some events that take place there as Jesus, in very purely and exclusively now Gentile territory, now presents himself to these people very briefly and then returns to Galilee again. This morning then now, the center of the events that are so famous in Peter's great declaration that thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God, will be taking place right here in this town that bears quite a few names, as a matter of fact. Typically, we refer to this as Caesarea Philippi. As very many cities have been named after Caesar. Very many cities have Caesarea on the front. They need a second name to designate which Caesar is being honored in the process. Though in this case, Philippi, this Philip was not actually a Caesar, so we're going to honor both men, Caesar and one of his ruling subjects. So we're going to be in that area right there, page 115, as I pointed out. But also, I just want to make mention of the fact that this is as far north as you can go in Israel, and really kind of for two reasons. Not just because you're getting outside the confines of the promised land that God had given to the original Jewish tribe, but as we'll see, Caesarea Philippi is right at the foot of what rises to become Mount Hermon, Mount Hermon is the biggest mountain in the area. It's over 9,000 feet high, so it's a very significant mountain. It has a ski resort on the Israeli side. The mountain split between Lebanon and Israel. That's on the eastern side. There's actually a ski resort there now. Dan is exactly 2.3 miles, and according to Google Earth, 90.7 degrees west of Caesarea Philippi. So this expression, Dan to Beersheba, you hear so much in the Old Testament, refers to the northernmost and then the southernmost boundary of Israel. When Jesus is in Caesarea Philippi, he is due east 2.3 miles from that Dan, which was universally recognized as their northernmost city. This is a Google Earth photograph right here. We call this area Caesarea Philippi. Today it's referred to either as Banias, B-A-N-I-A-S, or Panias. Both terms are used interchangeably, and it can be a little bit confusing. You'll go over there, you know your Bible is really ready, you're going to see this place, and you're talking about Caesarea Philippi, and the local Israelis are looking at you, what are you talking about? It's Banias or Panias to them. Now, this is obviously the parking area. You can see some buses and all right there. But I wanted you to see how much water is just issuing forth out of this cliff face that I'm about to show you. It's just one of the sources of the Jordan River there in the far north of Israel. And so this location, and most especially this barren area that you see right here, is a cliff face. You notice that shadow right there as well. And as we go now to an actual sign that's at the location there. It has a legend that identifies these buildings, and we're going to do that in just a minute. But this location of Caesarea Philippi is one of the more important locations for Romans and for Greeks and for Gentiles in general in their idolatrous worship. So that in the time of Jesus and the apostles, this little location right here had several serious temples dedicated to a number of different gods, both mythical as well as human Caesars there. And this complex is a go-to resort area of the time for people who intend to do worship to their Caesar as well as to their various other gods. So it was a beautiful sight, just physically. It's a majestic location. But it also had human structures there and a wide range of activities that made it an extremely important and popular location. We're going to zoom in on this lower part right here now and identify those. This largest of the temples right here, really, floor space and all, is a temple to Augustus, who by this time has been declared to be a god. Now, he died in 14 A.D., so at this time, this is 16, 17, 18 years after his death, as we're looking at these events, but they are worshiping him in a temple that is dedicated to him. And then from the aerial shot, I mentioned that little shadow, there is a very large cave at the end of this building, and that is referred to as the Grotto of Pan. So Augustus was a real human being. Augustus was an emperor, and a great emperor, now one of the longest lived of all the emperors, but he's been dead for 17 or 18 years now. They're worshiping him now. Pan, though, is that, half man, half goat god that you see in Greek literature and Roman literature as well. And that grotto, that cave, is dedicated to him. More on that in just a second. But immediately next to that is the court of Pan. You can see right here that they had niches carved into the cliff face where they put various idols, and those niches are still very plainly visible to this day, though the courtyard in front of it is no longer there. Then that second large structure is the Temple of Zeus. If you look at it here, is a much lower structure there, but that is the Temple of the Sacred Goats. Okay? Pan, of course, being half goat. And then this structure more toward the front is the Temple of Pan. See the theme of the location, Pan, Pan, Pan. And then the dancing goats. Apparently there was a statue there of goats engaged in some kind of dance routine. This is an extremely immoral place. The activities that are associated with Pan are the worst, you know, of human sinfulness. The site is dedicated to glorifying immorality. And so Pan, one of the more notorious of those, he had given himself over to every kind of debauchery, is the center figure of Caesarea Philippi, to which Jesus has gone. Now today, you can see that there's a lot of red that's in these rocks. It's a very sheer cliff face. The temple is gone, but its old foundation still remains. The grotto is now fully exposed, and it's quite large, the cave right there. And then you'll see, issuing quite literally straight out of the face of the rocks, is a huge amount of water, just a massive amount of water that just boils out and then becomes one of the sources of the Jordan River. So it's just a phenomenally beautiful location. You see, at that time, though, I guess the leaves would fall, you know, turning to get late in the year there, so not quite as pretty as it might have been. So with that background, we'll say a little bit more about it at the start of the sermon later, too. There will be no more slides, and we're just going to go to Caesarea Philippi at the bottom of page 115 at Mark chapter 8. Now, I have to be careful here. We don't know exactly where Jesus stood when this event takes place, this singularly important event recorded by three of the gospel writers, where Peter really gets it briefly. You know, and then messes up again. But is my mic okay?
Yeah.
Okay. We've been having some struggles with it. I got a new location here, so if you are having a problem with it popping or whatever, make sure you tell us about it, talk to Jerry about it, and we'll continue to work on that. We've had several problems last week and before with it. Okay, but what I'm saying is that we know, as you can see at the bottom there, that in Mark 8:27, Jesus went out along with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he questioned his disciples, saying to them, "Who do the people say that I am?" Over here in Matthew chapter 16 at verse 13, it says, "When Jesus came into the what of Caesarea Philippi?" The district of Caesarea Philippi. And as a matter of fact, in Luke 9 it says, "It came about while he was praying alone, the disciples were with him, and he questioned them, saying, what or who do the multitudes say that I am?" So please don't get the impression that Jesus was standing there amidst those temples at the Grotto of Pan. He wasn't. He was in the district, though. He was in an area that was dedicated and renowned for that. And what he is going to be saying, I think unquestionably, is related to that. So remember, in a moment, when we get to the gates of Hades, what are the gates of Hades? In their mythology of the day, it is the Grotto of Pan, which they believed you can walk into that cave and climb down, you know, do your spelunking, and you would be able to go all the way to the realm of the dead, where you could see the god Hades in their mythology and the dead. They thought that there was a gateway to Hades itself there that they identified as the Grotto of Pan. So while Jesus is not apparently standing there looking at the cliff face, he's not on the pavement or in one of those areas that we've been showing you, he is immediately adjacent to it. He's in the district. He's in the area. And the people there are hypersensitive to the expression gates of Hades in this exchange. So now, using Mark as our central text here for another moment, turn to page 116. Jesus initiates this discussion. He initiates it with his disciples. Thanks to Luke, we know, he's the only one that mentions it, he was praying alone and the disciples with him when this question is put to them. So, there's not a vast throng that's available. It is, you know, the apostles, but again, they know. We've gone to the center of the most idolatrous and profligate scenes of false worship that you can imagine. And so, in verse 28, they answered, Mark 8 still, they told him, saying, "John the Baptist, others, Elijah. But others, one of the prophets. And please note, again, if you look over at Luke's column in verse 19, one of the prophets of old has what? Risen from the dead. So that's important. And once again, the beauty of the harmony and its helpfulness, you know, is seen here. Typically, and I've purposely not gone to Matthew for this reason, Matthew 16 is the only account that most people know about this. Matthew 16, for some reason, is the one we remember. Where did, you know, this expression, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God," come from? And most of you would be able to say, oh, well, that's Matthew 16. And if I said, well, where is it in Mark? You'd shrug your shoulders. Where is it in Luke? And again, you'd probably shrug your shoulders. But thanks, particularly to Luke, we are told that when they say, well, we think that this is John the Baptist, or this is Elijah, or this is one of the other prophets, that they were not presenting the idea of a vision. They were not suggesting that Jesus, you know, that these people were thinking that Jesus didn't exist in the flesh, or that he was something, you know, what we might call paranormal. These people, you know, were suggesting that one of the prophets of old had resurrected from the dead and was physically back, and that's who Jesus was. So there are two very different concepts there, and they certainly had an idea of visions and that sort of thing, but this, they're thinking in very carnal terms. Now, where are we? Caesarea Philippi. In Jewish terminology, that's one thing. In Gentile terminology, if somebody was going to come back from the dead, where would they pop up? Out of the gates of Hades. Okay? So Jesus is going to be addressing an idea that people are discussing, both Jew and Gentile, and he's going to do it at the location where the Gentiles would argue that if we've got some kind of a resurrection or somebody back from the physical dead, this is the place where we would first expect them to appear. So, he continued questioning them in verse 29. Who do you say that I am? Peter answered and said to him, you are the Christ, in Mark's account. You are the Christ of God, in Luke's account. Matthew 16's account is more full, and that's why it's the one we always go to and the one we remember. From this point on, in fact, as you look at the page in your harmony, do Mark and Luke even record what's about to take place? You know, they don't. So they have pieces to the puzzle that make it come into much sharper focus for us, but because they don't add this exchange that takes place starting with verse 16b in Matthew, you know, then they kind of get overlooked in the study. Now in verse 16, we have to shift over now to Matthew's column. In verse 16, Simon Peter answered and said, you are the Christ. What's the Greek word? It's translated Christ here. What's the Greek word? Christos. Now, it's not translated here at all. It's transliterated. The Greek word, Christos, becomes Christ. But they didn't translate it. They're not telling you what the word means in English. They're telling you what it sounds like in Greek. Okay? So the word is Christos. It comes to be Christ then. You're the Christ. But in his mind, knowing the translation, what did Peter just say? You are the what? The anointed one. This is the word for anointed. You're the anointed one. Who do they anoint in Jewish religious activities and politically? Who do they anoint? Prophets, priests, and kings. To be an anointed one then suggests that we're looking at a prophet, a priest, or a king. People are thinking, maybe a prophet risen from the dead, maybe even issuing forth from these very gates. So Jesus is described as the Christ. He is also identified as the Son of God, but not just God. What was the full thing that Peter said? Son of the what God? the living God, the Son of a living God, not a dead God, not a risen from the dead man, but a living God that Jesus is serving and is the anointed one thereof. Now, 17, Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Now, we'll stop here for just a minute. I know all of you are very familiar with all this. About 3-4 weeks ago, we had a discussion in John chapter 6, verse 63. My words are, Jesus said in John 63, my words are spirit, and they are life. His words are spirit, and they are life. Now note, when Peter says, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God," Jesus' response is, "You're blessed because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Does that mean that at that moment, Peter was just suddenly somehow filled with the Holy Spirit and informed that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Does this expression that flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven, require inspiration, the miraculous placement of knowledge into his head? It does not. It doesn't. Where's he just spent the last year and a half? Peter. With Jesus the Christ. Who's he been listening to preach? Who's he been watching work miracles? How did he figure out that this is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Has Peter ever read an Old Testament? Well, he has. He's certainly been in synagogues where it's been read to him. And so, brother, I don't think this is a miraculous revelation at all. I think it is the same way that you and I are taught by God and led by God. He had the advantage of seeing the miracles. He had the advantage of peppering Jesus with questions. He had the advantage of sitting at his feet and listening to the sermons that he presented. I think this is the manner in which he figured it out. He got the evidence. He got the information. He was told by the living God. But not that it was just inserted into his head. It was revealed by God through Jesus in the things that he said and that he did. Now, 18, I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not, New American Standard translates, overpower it. That's a great and excellent translation. There are others out there. I like that the best. But also say that you are Peter. Upon this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not overpower it. Now, in churches of Christ, I think that there are few things that we know better than this. So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it, you know, today. You're so familiar with the fact that the word for Peter in the Greek and the word for rock in the Greek come from a common root, but they have two different endings, one masculine and one feminine, which designate in the Greek language one that is a rock like they were looking at in Caesarea Philippi. Remember the picture. What was that cliff like? It's just one gargantuan rock. It is also, at the bottom, issuing forth water from what we would call what kind of rock? Coming right out of the bedrock is what we would call it. Okay? That one word is the second word. The first word, as Peter's name comes from, means a small stone or a pebble, and carries the idea of something that you could carry in one hand. Big difference between these two words. So, you and I are very familiar here. When he says, "Upon this rock I'll build my church," is that rock that the church was built on Peter? Absolutely, emphatically not, and impossible to be, because specifically in the Greek we are taught in the language of the two words that Peter is not the rock that the church is built on. I guess I make a big deal out of this all my life because I, of course, grew up in the Catholic Church, went 7 years to Catholic school, did the Mass 6 days a week, you know, 5 days a week before school, you know, heavily indoctrinated in all this, certainly got taught all this from my youth up, that Peter's the rock. And in Catholic mythology, which is as close to an understanding of God, I think, as the Grotto of Pan's, you know, teachers would get you, this mythology, brethren, you know, carries the idea that Peter is a pope. Is there a pope anywhere in the Bible? No. There's as much about the pope in the Bible as there is about Pan in the Bible. You've got as much right to call Peter the first Pan. Took a while to sink in there, didn't it? As you do to call Peter the first pope. Peter is not Pan. Peter is not the pope. But there's a rock that everything is built on, and it isn't that cliff either. What is the rock that everything is built on? That Christ is the Son of the living God. That Jesus is the anointed one. Okay? So what Peter said in verse 16 is the foundation of the church. Not the man. The message which God has been presenting to these people, and Peter now has gotten in a very spectacular manner and coincidentally in a very spectacular place somewhere close by that those grottos. Now in 19, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. And whatever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Now, once again, since this is something that we focus on a lot in churches of Christ, and well, we should, as we do battle with the denominational world, try to lead them back to Christ and the actual teachings of the New Testament. Catholics have been pretty prominent and impressive and influential in America, you know, so we've had to work with them. But in this verse, 19, Peter may not be a pope, but he has been given what? The keys of the kingdom, whatever that means. Now, since we spend so much time on it, somebody tell me, really dig deep, see if you can tell me, that verse is not translated as well as it could be in this version of the New American Standard. Oddly enough, in an earlier translation, the New American's been around since 1966, or 61 maybe even, but since then, you know, the early days of the New American Standard, this verse was translated differently and better. Now, I don't know why they've changed it now. But if you were to give a much more accurate, very meticulously precise translation of the verb that's used in verse 19, can anybody tell me what would be a better way to translate this? Whatever you shall bind on earth, what? Shall be bound. Is the New American. How would you translate it, as they used to, better?
Have been.
That's it. This in the Greek is a particular tense, which is very, very clear and well understood and unarguable. And it carries an idea of past completed action that precedes what the apostle is doing. It is abundantly plain in the original Greek. So, add that, if you will, to the page of this Bible and your other Bible. Just put precise translation or something like that. Not shall be bound, which is somewhat misleading. Shall have been bound is the better translation. When you really dig around the Greek and all that, people don't argue about it. Popular translations, by and large, really good. Very seldom you have to have a beef like this. Really rare, but this is an important passage, and it is plain in the Greek. It's already bound. Whatever Peter's doing with the keys of the kingdom, is he making up the rules? Is he telling heaven how to behave? Is he declaring it first, and then heaven must follow suit? The Greek tense does not allow this any more than it allows him to be a pope. So he has the keys to the kingdom. We, you know, we'll have more to say about what we think that means. But what's bound, brethren,
is not bound by Peter and then enforced upon God. It's bound by God, and then it's understood by Peter.
It may be ratified by Peter. Peter can agree with this. Now, Peter's not changing what goes on in heaven. So I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you shall bind on earth, better, whatever you shall bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven, and whatever you shall loose on earth, same tense, shall have been loosed in heaven. Peter's going to have these keys, and these keys will allow him to know what has already been bound or loosed, where? In heaven. So when you have the keys of the kingdom, those keys allow you to work somehow with doors, if you will, that have already been opened or closed in heaven. You're going to do something down here that's already happened up there. Now, this is not the book of Acts, so I don't want to take a lot of time with it. But brethren, you know, now you go study the life of Peter, and you say, okay, he's got the keys of the kingdom. How's he going to use them? What is so obvious in Acts chapter 2 that it just leaps off the page? In Acts chapter 2, all the apostles are preaching. Peter's sermon is recorded. He preaches, and what happens immediately after he finishes? 3,000 people are baptized because they received the word. Those that received the word were baptized, the scripture tells us. So, the keys of the kingdom, brethren, is and are the word of God, which Peter's going to be receiving miraculously and by inspiration, presenting messages to God, as he does in Acts chapter 2, that were miraculously inserted into his head, and two books of the New Testament are going to be written by him. But the blessing that Jesus bestowed upon him at the outset of this event, I think Peter figured out by listening to Jesus, looking at the miracles, seeing what the Old Testament said, and putting it all together. Later, in Acts 2, the promise that Jesus will later give to Peter, that he and the other apostles would be filled with the Spirit, is fulfilled. And at that moment, I believe he receives those keys to the kingdom. It is the gospel, which he then is going to preach for the remainder of his life, and finally, you know, will cost him his life. Bob.
This verse 18 seems like a very good place to have a reference to Christ being the chief cornerstone of the church.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent. Christ is the cornerstone, not Peter. Peter's not the cornerstone. You know, and so outstanding point. And I can't remember what that actual verse reference is now. You have to find it, but it would be a good place, you know, to point that out. All right, so now we come to verse 20. Then he warned the disciples that they should tell no one, very specific in Matthew, tell no one what? That he was the Christ. That he was the anointed one. That Peter was right. Okay? Now Mark only says, he warned them to tell no one about what? Single word at the top of 117. About him. And in Luke says, he warned them and instructed them not to tell this to anyone, which might refer to the whole event or some, you know, particular part of it. But he straightly warned them. Okay, Peter got it. I'm telling you he did. This message is from heaven. I'm going to give you the keys of the kingdom. And I don't think Peter's the only one who got those keys. The other apostles got them as well. It wasn't unique to Peter in any sense. And so, then, don't you tell anybody I'm the Christ. Don't you talk about this. This is for you apostles. It's for nobody else. Now, continuing in Mark 8:31, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. How did Matthew put that? 16:21, what are the first three words? From that time. Jesus is on a timetable. It is the fullness of times, according to Galatians 4. But even so, it is an unfolding story, and he is training these apostles. He's working with these apostles. He's already sent them out to preach, and they've already themselves been working miracles. But the grasp of the fullness of who Jesus was, they didn't get like they did that moment when Peter was the first to blurt it out. But now that they did, he said, okay, you've got it. Now, you don't tell anybody yet. Time will come for that, but not now. Okay? The time now is that you understand I am the Christ, the Son of the living God, is to tell you that I need to go down into Hades.
Where are they? Okay. Now he said the gates of Hades shall not overpower the kingdom. What was he saying? Peter was blessed. The man said, Peter, the gates of Hades will not overpower what? The church that I'm going to build. Okay? That cannot happen. But immediately when they did all this, what's the first thing he now starts to tell them? I'm going to Hades. Okay? See, all that came together. But if they really get it, and they don't get it very well, we'll find out later, but they could have, okay, then how powerful is Hades against Jesus? Just not. So you look in that cave and fear nothing. There isn't anybody coming out of it save one. Who's that? That's Jesus. But when I go in, I'm going in voluntarily. I will be going in to solve the problem of your sins. And I have the power to take my life up again, he will tell them later. And he does. So, it is a marvelous moment, brethren. And you can see, you should try to take a page or two more than this. But this passage is just phenomenal. Jesus has lost his popularity. He's lost tens of thousands of followers. He's been up to see the Gentiles. He's come back down to the center of immorality in worship in Caesarea Philippi. And some are thinking that he's risen from the dead, maybe out of that very cave. Not so. But I'm going in, and then I'm coming out. Because I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. Don't tell anybody that yet. But now it's time for you to start getting that the Christ, Son of the living God, must die. So that's the first message. And then, in verse 32, using Mark as our text, he was stating the matter plainly. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, turning around and seeing his disciples. What are the disciples seeing? They're seeing Jesus being rebuked by Peter. So he turns around, wait a minute, this is being observed here. He rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but on man. And in verse 23 of the Matthew column, he added, you're a stumbling block to me. Peter, now you're really hurting. And so in a moment, it appears that Peter just undid all the good that he'd accomplished with his declaration. Immediately as Jesus starts now to be teaching them, I think immediately still involves days going by, but as this time is going on, you know, Peter is rejecting that Jesus will have to go into Hades. He's going to have to go into the realm of the dead. Then in 34, he summoned the multitude with his disciples, and he said to them, if anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. When Peter's rebuking Jesus, is he denying himself? No, he's denying what Jesus is teaching. He's denying Jesus. So now, everything is reversed. Peter's the one that's being rebuked. He's being exposed as a denier. He's being taught, along with everybody else, so that Jesus can correct his error publicly, that he needs to deny himself, take up his cross, and follow. 4, verse 35, whoever wishes to save his life shall lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel shall save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Brethren, look in Luke's column. We'll close with this on page 117. On page 117, look at Luke 9:23. And he was saying to them all, if anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life shall lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake, he's the one who will save it. For what is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits, what is the last word in Luke 9:25? Himself. Okay?
That's a better translation than soul that we have in most translations of Mark and Matthew. I've done this numerous times with this congregation already. For our visitor's sake, I'm out of time. Bell's going to ring any second. Just know, there is a single Greek word that is used four times in Matthew 16 and in Mark 8. Luke, in the translation of the New American Standard with himself, helps you to understand that. The New American Standard, I'm beefing again, in Matthew and in Mark, does a very poor job, along with virtually every other translation there is, in choosing to take that single word and translate it life the first two times and soul the second two times. It's the same identical Greek word. Pick life or pick soul. Because in English, they mean two different things. But whichever you pick, insert it into the text and ruminate on it. There's only one Greek word, not two. And the two Greek words are not suggesting physical life and an eternal soul. There's only one word. Pick one or the other idea, but stick with it. More on this next week. And thank you for your time.